Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Demands are growing in India for four men convicted of gang rape and murder of a 23-year-old woman to be handed the death sentence. The Delhi gang rape provoked outrage and debate across India about the way women are treated in the world's largest democracy. The men were found guilty this past week after an eight-month trial. But some human rights activists say the death penalty will do nothing to stop sexual assaults against women. Michael Edwards reports from India.
The four men were escorted out of the court complex amid tight security. On either side of their bus were demonstrators carrying banners, calling for the men to hang for the gang rape and murder of the 23-year-old student in New Delhi last December.
We are here to announce our demand that there should be a death penalty in every rape cases.
Now known to Indians as Nirbhaya, the victim's parents welcomed the conviction. Her father spoke of the family's long ordeal through their daughter's death and the trial.
I do believe that although the process of justice did take longer than we expected, and I didn't like that, but they have been proven guilty, and I am very happy. And now I am confident that our daughter will get justice.
Her mother believes the only way justice can be served is if the men receive the death penalty.
I think the message would spread throughout society, which would create fear in the minds of people, and men would at least think twice before doing such barbaric acts, and hopefully such incidents will come down, if not end completely.
The brutality of the attack shocked Indians, a place where brutal rapes and murders are reported in the media on a daily basis. The case resonated with thousands of urban people who took to the streets in fury. Public opinion seems largely in favour of the death penalty being handed down to the men.
I actually am for capital punishment because I think it's more fear-inducing and it's a warning for all the other men out there, so I'm for capital punishment.
But there are those who aren't so certain the death penalty will really help make women safer.
Well, personally speaking, I'm not for capital punishment because it's a very easy way of getting rid of them, but maybe keeping them in isolation from the rest of the world for the rest of their lives, now that is really a punishment because they won't see humanity at all.
Kavita Krishnan is an activist who was a leading figure during the protests after the Delhi gang rape.
I really wouldn't be happy with looking at this case as an exception and then expecting an exceptional verdict in it. Death penalty is always an exceptional verdict. I would rather expect a life sentence and something which is a punishment which can be adhered to, by other, which can set a standard which in every case of violence against women, this kind of sexual violence, in every case of rape, that kind of justice may be expected.
The teenager convicted over the gang rape received a 3-year jail term to be served in a juvenile facility. The sentencing hearing for the four adults begins today.
Michael Edwards reporting from India. A new study has found that nearly half of the men interviewed in the Asia-Pacific region have admitted to being violent against their female partner. The UN studied 10,000 men, also found nearly a quarter admitted raping a woman or a girl. The men studied were from Papua New Guinea, Bangladesh, Cambodia, China, Indonesia, and Sri Lanka. One of the report's authors is Dr. Emma Fula, and she's based in Bangkok. She speaks next to Sen Lam.
I mean, I think this study reaffirms perhaps what we have known by interviewing women in the past about their experiences of violence, and shows that violence is a pervasive issue across the region, as it is indeed globally. But I think what's new about this study is that it tells us for the first time by speaking to men about what the sum of the underlying causes are of that violence. And that helps us think about how we can prevent it.
And before we go to the causes, who are these men who've admitted to being violent against women? Were they from a specific demographic?
No, so it was a representative household sample of men aged 18 to 49. And that basically means that men were randomly selected to represent the sites that we studied. So they're not chosen because they were more violent or less violent. They should represent the general population.
And you spoke to men from six countries in the Asia-Pacific region. Did culture play any part in attitudes towards women, or did it vary from region to region?
Attitudes towards women varied quite significantly from region to region and country to country, but they were related to men's use of violence in some ways. So men who had more gender inequitable attitudes, for example, were more likely to use violence against women. And we see that sort of the sort of social norms in society, or what is considered normal in society, the acceptability of violence also plays a role in rates of violence across the region.
And Emma, how widespread is this belief of sexual entitlement, that once you marry a woman, you're entitled to have sex with or without her consent? How widespread is this belief?
Well, it certainly, our study indicates that it certainly is an issue. We did ask men who admitted that they had perpetrated rape what the primary motivation was for their behaviour. And the most common motivation that men themselves reported across the sites was related to sexual entitlement. And this was reinforced, I think, by the fact that many men who had perpetrated rape didn't face any legal consequences. And indeed, in many of the countries where we've done this research, marital rape is still not criminalised. And so there is an issue of impunity that needs to be addressed. But also, I think what we see is that, as well as a criminal justice response, we really need to start working towards trying to stop violence before it happens in the first place. And that's a longer-term project of working to change attitudes and beliefs and practices and among, particularly starting with young boys.
You spoke of impunity in some communities. What about the environment? Do you think violence against women might be more prevalent in countries with a recent history of, say, political violence, upheaval, such as civil war?
Mm-hmm. Well, we did actually find that the rates of violence were particularly high in our sites where there had been recent or ongoing conflict, for example. It's not the only cause of violence. We found that violence is really caused by, I guess, a bit of a complex interplay of various factors. But it certainly seems that we're sort of through processes where violence becomes somewhat normalised, for example, through conflict, that violence against women also has the potential to increase.
And do we know how these figures compare with similar surveys conducted elsewhere in the world?
Yes, well, there have been very few surveys. This is really the first survey of its kind done on this scale across countries with men themselves. Another similar survey has been conducted in South Africa, and the findings are similar in a sense and comparable, which indicates that across very diverse regions, that rates of violence are high, and many of the underlying causes are similar. And our study also does, I think, reaffirm, like I said, what we've found there's been quite extensive research done with women on their own experiences of violence. So it does reaffirm findings we have had from other studies, but does also offer new insights.
Dr. Emma Fula speaking there with Sen Lam. Taiwan's adultery law is in the spotlight again after a woman faced the theoretical possibility of almost three centuries in jail for an extramarital affair. While the court reduced the actual term to 2 years in jail and a substantial fine, the man avoided punishment after his wife decided to forgive him and drop the lawsuit against him. Tom Maddox has more.
Judges reportedly used confessions from the widow and her neighbour, estimating the pair offended a total of 894 times over a five-year affair. Each offence is worth up to 4 months in jail. The court, however, told the 56-year-old that 2 years in prison or a $27,000 fine was enough. Associate Professor Yi Qianqian is the director of the Graduate Institute for Gender Studies at Shenzhen University in Taiwan.
Immediately it hits me that, wow, you know, doesn't matter it's a rape case or doesn't matter it's an adultery case, women in general are the losers in the Taiwanese legal landscape.
In her assessment of the case, Ye Chun Chen says even the judges realized that this law is hanging on to the past.
The judge in this decision, he or she, of course, went to the facts of the case and all that, but actually said the protection of the family cannot only relying on law, something like that. Right? But he said, he mentioned that before the decriminalization of the adultery law and blah, blah, blah. So I think even the individual judge sensed that this is not reasonable in the modern Taiwanese society.
The United States and most European countries have abolished the crime. Japan has decriminalized it, and China doesn't even list it. It leaves Taiwan on an undesirable list with South Korea and Islamic countries. But in Taiwan, the prospect of repealing the legislation remains uncertain. In May, a Ministry of Justice survey revealed that almost 80% of the public said they opposed decriminalisation of the law. Lin Mei Sun is deputy executive of the Taiwan-based Modern Women's Foundation.
We would like to bring the issue to the public. When it exists, it affects women's interest. And also it becomes two women's fight more than to punish the male, the husband. So do we really need this law?
But Lin Mei Sun says some Taiwanese fear that if the law is dropped, it would take away a measure for punishing their husbands.
It's like a restraint, and that the wife can have a weapon, you know, against the husband. But if we take this law, then the wife might feel the lack of power to pursue the issues.
Ye Chen Chen says the law is gender neutral, but women still lose out.
If you go into the law, the details, and then you will understand in the current Taiwanese kind of gender not equal, not balanced relationship, in this social context, men can always walk away, but the result of maybe the broken marriage or a broken relationship will be shared by women. And now we are talking about women could be the wife, the third party, or the children and all that. This is not only outdated, but also the practice of law itself has a lot to do with the social context in Taiwan at the moment.
A leftover detail from the original version from the Republic of China era means unfaithful women are usually punished while cheating men walk free.
I say law is the gender neutral, but actually it's an offense prosecuted on complaint. So that means if the wife withdraws the complaint or forgives what the adulterous man did, and then the man can walk free, because in general, still in a lot of families, men are the breadwinner and because of the social structure. But second, I think most importantly is because still this law is better than nothing. If you see it from a practicing lawyer point of view or women's view, because there are a lot of irresponsible men. They walk out of the marriage without doing anything, and then they have all these affairs. But at the end, the wife has to face all the results of this marriage. And yeah, divorce is very difficult in Taiwan.
Ye Chen Chen says Taiwan needs a new perspective on gender relations. Lin Mei Sun agrees.
The meaning to decriminalize is not to depower women, because most of women are victims. This is for the women's rights advancement, and the government power cannot control, these domestic affairs. I think that might be the time, we can pass legislation. But at this stage, I think still very far.
In March this year, the law unexpectedly came into sharp focus when Minister of Culture Long Ying Tai told cabinet ministers she feels awkward when speaking to foreigners about the existence of the law. Long Ying Tai remarked, "It's a different era now. It is absurd that marriage should still rely on the support of judges, police officers, and detectives."
And that was Tom Maddox reporting. You're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Japan appears to be going through a revival with a successful Olympic bid and an economy that seems to be back on track. Analysts say the country is now in a winning streak as Prime Minister Shinzo Abe continues his bold program to kick life back into the economy. That seems to be working, but there are dual challenges with the huge national debt and an aging population. He still has his work cut out for him. Bill Bertels has more from Tokyo.
In the past few days, Japan has been on a roll. Saturday's announcement that Tokyo will host the 2020 Olympics was followed by some positive economic news on Monday. Official data showed Japan's GDP growth for the second quarter was higher than initially thought, being significantly revised up from 2.6% to 3.8%. Masamichi Adachi, a senior economist at JP Morgan in Tokyo, says the revision was due to three reasons.
First one, the biggest one, is the upward revision in the capital expenditures, business investment, and second is the public investment, and third one is the so-called a change in the inventories.
So what does this say about Japan's economy generally at the moment? Are we seeing sustained signs of recovery?
Yes, we are seeing basically very constructive signs of the recovery. Japanese economy is so-called potential growth rate. The trend growth rate is only 0.5%, but now we are seeing close to 4% in annualized base growth in the first quarter and second quarter. We probably need to see some slowdown in this summer, but the underlying trend of the growth is very solid. Therefore, we can say that the Japanese economy is doing quite well at the moment.
Japan's successful Olympic bid appears to have given the country an immediate economic boost, with Tokyo's Nikkei hitting a one-month high. Masamichi Adachi says the Games should give Japan a sustained boost.
This is not because of the direct impact of this game to the economic activities. Probably the biggest point is a sort of, you know, sentiment or a mood that Japan can sort of host the big international game in 7 years' time, then we need to invest more and we feel that we can do it again.
The dual good news of the Olympics and stronger growth should help Shinzo Abe's government maintain its positive approval ratings in Japan. But there's still plenty left to do. For one thing, the Fukushima nuclear cleanup is far from over. Only last week, Japan's government committed $500 million for it. And Japan still faces the huge problems of a massive national debt and an ageing population. Shinzo Abe will soon need to decide on whether to raise the country's sales tax, but chief economist at RBS Securities in Tokyo, Junko Nishioka, says keeping spending under control will also be a priority.
I think the first challenge for the Prime Minister Abe is to keep its fiscal consolidation stance. Of course, the LDP and Prime Minister Abe is going to push for its initial plan, the consumption tax hike, from next year. But not only that, the government has to move forward further fiscal consolidation, like a reduction of the social payment.
Tourism operators in Papua New Guinea are worried about the impact a brutal attack on a group of trekkers will have on the country's reputation and their businesses. A group of Australians and a New Zealander were attacked by a group of machete-wielding bandits on the Black Cat Track on Tuesday. Other trekking companies operating elsewhere in PNG fear the attack will fuel a stereotype that PNG is a dangerous and lawless land and will scare off tourists. Liam Fox reports from Papua New Guinea.
Mark Hitchcock's company, PNG Trekking Adventures, has been taking tourists along the Black Cat Track in Morobe Province for more than a decade. He says he's never seen or heard anything like the brutal attack on one of his trekking parties on Tuesday.
We're a local trekking company based here in Port Moresby. Myself and my wife have been in the country 23 years. We're very experienced with the conditions and the nature of the country, and we have never had an experience like this at all. We're deeply shocked, and we feel for both the trekkers and the porters.
On Tuesday afternoon, seven Australians and a New Zealander, along with their Australian tour guide and local porters, had set up camp after a hard day's walk. It was raining, so most people were in their tents when a group of men armed with machetes burst out of the jungle and started to attack. The porters bore the brunt of the attack. Two were killed and several others were seriously injured. The trekkers received relatively minor injuries, just lacerations and bruises. To the south, Wayne Weatherall's trekking company, Kokoda Spirit, has several groups out on the rugged Kokoda Track. He says word of the attack on the Black Cat spread fast.
You know, there's been a lot of sort of family members sort of ringing in and just getting updates. We've also took a forward motion of actually contacting all our trackers going out and letting them know what the situation is and letting making sure people are very much aware this has got nothing to do with the Kakata track.
Mr. Weatherall is worried the attack will deter tourists from coming to PNG. His and other businesses took a major hit back in 2009 when a plane crashed near Kokoda, killing 13 people. 9 of them were Australian trekkers.
Now, this is an isolated incident in an isolated part of PNG. And, you know, I think the long-term effect will be minimal, but there'll certainly be some short-term pain when, you know, people get a little bit nervous about these sorts of things.
Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister Peter O'Neill has condemned the attack. He says those responsible will face the death penalty for murder, which was recently reinstated by PNG's parliament. Mr. O'Neill says the attack is an obvious setback to efforts to promote PNG as a tourist destination. Wayne Weatherall says the PNG government, the Tourism Promotion Authority and tourism businesses will need to redouble their efforts to sell the country.
It's one of the great wilderness areas of the world, and it's one of the last frontiers, and you know, to be a part of, you know, visit the PNG is something very special. So, you know, the message needs to get out there. This is a great place. Mate, incidents happen in Australia every day. Poor old PNG cops a bad rap in the media as soon as something goes wrong.
The trekkers who were attacked on the Black Cat track flew to Port Moresby yesterday, and they're expected to fly back to Australia later today.
And finally on the program, something of interest to those who are golfers. I don't know how many of you are listening right now, but in case you are going to be in Vanuatu, which could be difficult for some of you, the Vanuatu Golf Open is underway in the capital, Port Vila, and is attracting a number of professionals, including 24 Australians. One of them is Peter Weldon, who expects some tough competition at the Mela Golf Club. He speaks next to Hilar Boulay.
It's my second year here. I've come to a lot of the island events over the years. That's my second year in Vanuatu. Happy to be here. Got a good field of professionals this year. It's only small, but a good field. And the golf course is looking good. I had a practice round yesterday, and the golf course is looking in great shape. So it should be a good week.
So what your pronostic? I know you have a champion for this tournament. He's Brad McIntosh. What is your pronostic?
Yeah, look, Brad's going to be hard to beat. I mean, he's been over here for many years. He's won it 3 times or 4 times, I believe, so he'll be difficult to beat. We also have Neil Sarkis, who is leading our Order of Merit in New South Wales, so he's a good player. Plus, we've got tour players from Australia that have had, you know, good results in the past and are having pretty good results at the moment. I know Adam Bland, who's played over in America, is here this week from South Australia, and he's been a leader in the Australian Masters a few years ago. So there's a pretty good pedigree of players here this week.
The competition would be very tough.
Yeah, I think so. Even though it's a smaller field, I think it's probably one of the higher calibre fields I've seen for the amount of players that are here. So it should be a great week and good viewing.
How many professionals from Australia are taking part in this competition?
I think we have 24 professionals and a young professional from Fiji, who's Vikrant Chandra, who's a very good player. I played with him in Samoa this year. It's his first year out, and he's a very, very good young player, so he'll be one to watch as well.
It is not first time that Vanuatu Golf Open is taking place. What do you think of the level of the golf, especially in the Pacific?
Yeah, look, the golf courses here are really good. The grass is a bit different, so, you know, you try and get over a little bit early and get used to the grass. But as far as the courses are concerned, other Pacific courses, this is one of the best layouts I've seen. And as far as I can see so far this year, the quality of the course is really good. The greens are running nice and true. There's a lot of grass on them. So, as I said, it should be a good week, and I think you'll see some good scores.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com, or you can check out our website for more information about the region at www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. And I also want to remind you again to catch another edition of Focus Asia Pacific Sunday at 1330 UTC on 11835 kHz with Andy Sennett. And that's at 1330 UTC on Sunday. The show is, of course, a little bit different from this because it's only 15 minutes, and then it's followed by the Happy Station Show. To end off today, we're going to listen to Singaporean singer Stephanie Sun from her latest album, The song is called Perfect. So until next time, friends, this is Keith Powell wishing you well. We'll see you in 7 days' time. Goodbye, everyone.